Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 53 of Allied Strategies. My name is Tristan. Joining me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Neil.
Ooh, I'm first again.
And Ben.
Saving the best for last.
I thought we had agreed to not talk about the order of introductions. I thought that was a no-no from a couple weeks ago.
Look, you're the one who's bringing it up now. We could have just had a smooth sail right into the next little segment.
Speaking of the next little segment, it's the RPTQ, which was last weekend. So, Ben, how did the RPTQ go for you?
I failed to win my final match, which was in the top 8 of the RPTQ. But at least I qualified for the next RPTQ.
Which you are already qualified for by virtue of being silver, right?
That's correct. Well,
so really,
I lost, and I was very sad. But at least, you know, I got to make someone very happy to go to the Pro Tour in Sydney. So,
yeah, because you were only playing for the flight, right? You already had an invite. It was just a silver invite. So
that's correct. I'm going to go to Sydney, but I have to pay my way there, which is pretty darn expensive. So I was pretty sad to lose match, but you know, it's always good to look at the silver lining, which is that someone probably was a lot happier for winning that match than I would have been had I won. So.
Right, the like net utility of the world is higher, but your utility's lower. That's sad. How about you, Neil? You were playing for this. Was this your last chance to go to Sydney?
Yep, I am officially Dobberoonies, so I will not be going. The history of the last 3 years is I've made it to 3 out of 4 Pro Tours every year, and so this is the third year of that. So it's unfortunate to miss, but it's not the end of the world or anything. I'm still silver. I started off okay. I started off 2-0 in that tournament, but the wheels fell off pretty quickly and just a bunch of unfortunate things. And I thought my deck was pretty good. I actually had a few good rares and stuff, but like my opponents had a couple better rares or like a lot of close games. Like I had a game where I had Always Watching and I was like really sort of in the driver's seat, but my opponent had an Audric and like 4 abilities every turn, and it was really, really close. So, yeah, I ended up going 2-4 at the RPTQ, which was really bad.
But, I was spectating that match. That was against friend of the podcast, Lee Lin.
Who
had that Audric going and remembered that it worked on your turn as well, which was pretty big because he had a Death Toucher out.
Yeah, that was going to be a tough one to win. But move on. I mean, it's just that kind of stuff's always disappointing after you practice a ton, but that's just true of Magic anyways. Like, you know, we practice our tournaments and sometimes they don't go well.
That's true. And then I, of course, was planning to play in the LCQ, but then I decided on the day of that I didn't want to. Some say that it's because I didn't want to get up, but I reserve the right to say that I am a free American and made a life choice of my own volition to not play in the LCQ, but I will potentially...
Isn't that what not wanting to get up is?
Look, Neil, I plead the fifth, which is another thing I'm allowed to do as a free American, so...
To be fair, very happy that you didn't go to the LCQ because that meant we got to cube, and then I got to draft a really sweet Storm deck for the first time. And man, it was great.
This was Saturday. Yeah, we cubed, and for the first time ever, only one person at the table tried to draft Storm, and it was Ben, and his deck was so good. Normally, whenever we draft Ben's cube, like 3 or 4 people try and draft Storm. But this time I decided to draft. I drafted this awful, like, 4-color mid-range Splinter Twin Pestermite, you know, Entomb Gristlebrand reanimate deck that was just awful.
That's didn't end up
working. Classic Living Twin.
I think it would have maybe worked better if I'd been, like, blue and had... Blue was the color that I had the fewest sources of. I didn't have any way to go through my deck, so... I think that was how I ended up losing every time there, is that I just never had enough ways to draw into any of my great combos.
Drawing cards is really great. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, the problem was that every single other person at the table was drafting decks that drew cards. So,
can't beat them, join them.
Yeah. Also, Ben added a lot more extra duels to the cube, and I have a very hard time passing dual lands, and so I drafted too many lands, I think, because my deck had 3 basics and 14... non-basics in it. So
the quick tip is drafting fixing is way, way, way better in like legacy cubes because there are just less broken things. In vintage cube, you just really need a streamlined deck that's much more powerful.
You did cast Rathalos off of, I think, two green dual lands that weren't forests.
My deck did have Gristlebrand, Ancient Tomb, Library of Alexandria, Rathalos, Splinter Twin.
This reminds me of a really, really great cube story real fast where I was playing against our friend Kyle Pratt and
friend of the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I don't remember exactly what my deck was doing, but he just goes like forest Llanowar Elves. And I'm like debating what land I'm going to play. And I'm like, I'll play this good, like tap land. There's not really that much that can punish me in like those colors or whatever. And then he just goes Twilight Mire Sinkhole. I'm just like, why me?
Yeah. One thing that our local group of cubers does like to do is blow up lands. So
yes, that was pretty funny.
definitely doesn't sound great for you. Anyways, we have a number of comments from listeners that we're going to address this week. Neil, you have the first one. Is somebody told you a nice story about their Lorwyn draft experience?
Yeah, this one's from Ochre Proker from the Twitch stream. And so he told me that in one of his games, he had a Cloudgoat Ranger, and his opponent cast Nameless Aversion to kill it, because, of course, Cloudgoat Ranger is the bee's knees. But he said, and so he activated a Shaldok Isle and then put Protective Bubble on his Cloudgoat Ranger at instant speed to make it unblockable, but more importantly, a Shroud and Fizzle the Nameless Inversion. So that's kind of a pretty sweet play with Shaldok Isle. Also, Shaldok Isle is just great and limited. So good job, Ochre Proker.
Nice little achievement where the timing restriction on your hideaway lands, or like breaking the timing restriction with your hideaway lands, becomes relevant.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, if we had been doing achievements back then, that would definitely be one of them.
Yeah, the hideaway lands in general are just such like delightful cards whenever you get to activate them.
Mm-hmm.
That's feels really, really good.
Also, then when Morning Tide would have come out in the, like, if we were doing achievements and we were podcasting back then, we would then have to have a second set of achievements where if you hideaway land the hideaway creature.
Oh yeah, you know, definitely. That would have been 100% on the list.
Big flavor win there.
Yeah.
So if anyone does that, let us know next week, because right now Morning Tide just got added to the mix on Magic Online.
Yeah, I'm going to be playing a bit of that probably over this weekend, so should be fun. I like these flashback drafts because I've never actually drafted these formats before, so having a lot of fun discovering something new every week. Then also we have some people interested in like direct download links for this podcast. I'm looking into that now, but I'll hope to have that up in the coming days, little direct download links next to each episode on our website, so you can download these without needing to use iTunes or whatever RSS reader you like, if you don't like any of those. So stay tuned for that. Also stay tuned for us to, you know, spruce up the site in general. I'm going to do some work on that over the next couple weeks. And then the final comment we got a very long response, over 4,000 words, from Wandering Winder, who is a moderator of Neil's stream, and I think we've met him at a GP or something. Is that correct, Neil?
Yeah, we met him at GP Houston
a
few months ago, so that was nice.
Indeed. And he had a very long response, very, very well thought out, and a very different perspective from us on the cheating that we talked about last week, which is good. I mean, one of the problems, I think, with last week's episode is that all three of us have very similar views on this issue, and normally our podcast, we have you know, more divergent views and we get into more of a debate. So this is a nice way to introduce some outside views. So I'm not going to read all 4,000 words of it, but we've summarized it into a few different points. We hope we haven't missed anything big about this, but we're just going to quickly go through his points and, you know, air him here on the show, talk about them. I think he's definitely right about some things. And then we also have, you know, some clarifications of our position on some others. So first off, he really wanted to emphasize that he thinks forgiveness is an important point of the cheating policy, and that our position of, you know, somebody who is a cheater is going to cheat every time and, you know, is necessarily from here on out going to be a cheater. He didn't like that position and thinks that that's not, you know, necessarily accurate. And he thinks that, in fact, you know, of people who were caught cheating and then come back to the game, more often than not, they're not going to cheat anymore. And this is a difficult thing to prove either way, but it's definitely a valid point that, you know, at the end of the day, these are all human beings. And, if we have a, you know, a criminal system that assumes we can rehabilitate people from burglary or theft, then presumably people can be rehabilitated from cheating in a card game as well, and not do that anymore as well. So
I think a
point well taken.
I think having an avenue to forgiveness, or having an ability to have a second chance, is should be a goal of the cheating system. I think proposed like one way of trying to like having them make an effort to earn forgiveness. And I stand by that. I think that you should do that, but there are a number of ways of introducing the possibility of forgiveness into the cheating rules. And I do think that Wandering Winder is correct in that it's important that's there.
Then he also took issue with our a number of attacks we made on Fabrizio and Terry directly as personal attacks that perhaps were, I don't know, either unfair or unprofessional or somewhere in the middle of those.
Can I just speak to that really quickly?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's important that I don't think we were ever intending to attack and Terry. Like, that was never my point. He was just the most recent example of someone who was suspended for grounds of cheating, essentially. And so, we're using that as essentially a case study. And so a lot of things we were saying, like, and Terry did this and he was cheating his opponent that way, come off sounding like we have a vendetta against him personally, and I don't think that's necessarily true. And I don't like Antary, and I don't dislike him. I'm very neutral because I've never really met him. I don't really have an opinion of him. But I think we wouldn't want that to be necessarily be misconstrued.
Right.
Yeah. I think we went a little too far last podcast. But I think that it's still important, like, emotions, I feel very strongly about the issue, and I think my emotions were running a little high, and I regret, I think, acting the way we did on the last podcast, but...
I don't know, I mean, I don't think we did anything, wrong in our portrayal of the situation. Like, the thing is that, this guy became the face of cheating, and therefore, feelings we have directed at the act of cheating get directed at the man as well, and, at the end of the day, a lot of the negative feelings towards this guy are not necessarily based on him as a person, but based on, the crime that he now represents, or not the crime, but the cheating that he represents. So,
right.
I think that's an important clarification to make.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a little unfair. I mean, I think that he's a human being just like anyone else. And it's not fair to he's not cheating incarnate. Right. And so,
yeah, so
I think that Wandering Winder made a good point in that we shouldn't really treat him like cheating incarnate, right? He did cheat, and you're right in that he's the most recent one, but I don't know. I just think that I personally might have gone a little too far.
Yeah, we might have all gone a little bit too far there. Also, I think, Ben, you were saying you might have regretted a little bit. I think there might have been certain spots where we said, where, the fact that we are passionate about the issue and trying to make it into an as important an issue as we feel it is, could have made things certainly seem that way. So I don't think any of us meant any direct harm to anyone in particular or the community at large. Certainly if that happened, we're sorry for that. But I'm not going to apologize for wanting to be passionate about the topic. So I just want to be clear about that.
Great.
Yeah, I guess mostly just he cheated. I hope he doesn't cheat again when he comes back.
Yep, sounds good. All right, certainly. Moving on.
Yeah, moving on. Then he started talking about cheating, and this is, I think, a point where it became clear that we hadn't really done a good job of explaining what exactly cheating is as a definition, because he made some suggestions that, somebody who just does a pile shuffle or does a mana weave of some description and then shuffles their deck is cheating, and that's actually not the definition of cheating. So I'm going to read out now the definition of cheating, or some selections of it, from the actual infraction procedure guide. So unsporting conduct cheating is defined as a person breaking a rule, lying to a tournament official, or noticing an offense committed in his or her teammate or teammate's match and does not call attention to it. And additionally, they need to be attempting to gain an advantage from that action, and they need to be aware that they're doing something illegal. And if all of those criteria are not met, the offense is not cheating and should be handled by a different infraction. So this is a pretty big deal, because the word cheating, like if you do something that's actually against the game rules, but you don't know it, like you resolve a card incorrectly, or you forget to point out your own, you forget one of your own triggers, which is something that you're not allowed to do, but by, you know, on purpose, but you're allowed to do by accident, then that is not cheating. If you pile shuffle and your goal is not to make it so that you draw more lands or a better mix of lands and spells, and your goal is just, you know, to count out your deck, or because that's how you shuffle and you're not, you know, trying to gain an unfair advantage and know that you're doing something illegal, you're not cheating. So this is a really, really precise definition, and it requires those two requirements are very important, that you know it's illegal and you're doing it to gain an advantage. And the vast majority of the time that I think people get worried about, you know, talking about increasing the penalties for cheaters is because, you know, they think that something that they've done would count as cheating, when in fact the vast majority of offenses that normal people commit are just, you know, gameplay errors, because this game is very complicated and there's a great deal of things that you can resolve incorrectly, and that is not cheating. Cheating requires you to know that you're doing something wrong and be doing it to gain an advantage, and that the majority of cases, that's not something that goes on. So I think that's an important distinction that we didn't do a good enough job explaining in our last episode. But when we talk about cheating, it does mean something different than just, you know, you didn't follow the rules of the game, which is an important distinction that the word doesn't necessarily carry inherently in it. Then he makes another interesting point, which is that increasing the length of the ban is not going to actually have an impact on, like, an expected value calculation that somebody would make if they can't, assuming they can't, you know, profit at Grand Prix without cheating, which is true for almost everybody in the world, then, you know, increasing the length of the ban is not actually going to change whether or not it's plus EV to cheat. But, and this is actually a really interesting point as well, because it's kind of a similar point that gets applied to, like, criminal justice, which is, you know, are you really going to change somebody's incentive structure if you increase the length of punishment from, you know, X years to double that? And it's, yeah, I don't know. I don't really have a good answer to that either. Part of what we're trying to accomplish is to keep them away from the game for longer, if they are still going to be cheating when they come back. And then another part of it is that even if they don't make more, like, even if they're not going to make more money or less money by keeping them away from the game for longer, you know, it is just a viscerally harsher punishment, which might help deter people from committing the crime. I don't know. I'm not sure that that's a good argument. What do you think, Ben?
I think his point was that people don't act rationally in that sense. Like, there have been a lot of studies that have shown that people, like, if you increasing the tickets for drunk driving doesn't actually prevent drunk driving as much as convincing people that they're more likely to get caught.
Right.
Like, it doesn't, people usually don't worry, at least these studies argue that people don't worry about what the actual punishment is, because they just don't think they're going to get caught.
Interesting. So maybe a better thing to do than increasing the length of the ban is make sure that people think they're going to get caught for sure.
If you had a limited effort, almost certainly a better thing to do than increasing the ban length would be to educate people how to catch and prevent cheating.
Right, which is...
That's much harder to do than just increasing the ban length. So there's some cost there. But I think he definitely, like, just increasing ban length is probably not going to deter cheating that much.
Right. It's similar evidence to, like, the people who are opponents of the death penalty bring up as evidence that, you know, it's the death penalty doesn't increase deterrence as well, which is, of course, not an issue we're going to get into on this podcast. But, you know, certainly interesting thing to think about. Then he brings up performance-enhancing drug suspension policies in sports, which is something we tangentially mentioned last week as, you know, something to support our point. And his point is that if you, in fact, look at the actual policies of, you know, the NBA or the NFL, people who get caught doing performance-enhancing drugs get suspended for much less time than actually a first-time offender getting caught for cheating in Magic. And it's, you know, it's a valid point, but I think that it's difficult to actually compare these things directly, because in sports, you know, there's just so many different things going on. And also, you know, missing 8 weeks of sports is worth millions of dollars for most of these players, whereas missing, you know, any amount of time playing Magic is really a negligible impact on somebody's finances, might actually make them more money to miss playing Magic. So I think for that reason, it's difficult to directly compare those two things, but another interesting thing to think about for sure. And then he brings up a point that, you know, the way that we talked sort of could have dehumanized cheaters, and that's something that we already talked about earlier when we, I guess, in our response when we talked about that it is important that, to remember that these people are still human as well. And I do think that we maybe didn't emphasize that enough, that, you know, we don't think people are subhuman just because they choose to cheat at Magic, but we do think they're doing something wrong, and that is mostly was most of our point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you cheat, I don't think you're subhuman at all. But I mean, I do think less of people who cheat. Just, you know, it is something wrong that you've done, and you know, I reserve the right to judge people based on that. But certainly, you know, it's not like the end of it all, right? People who cheat can make it up, right? Like they're not inherently bad people. It is possible they just made a mistake or
right. It doesn't make you a bad person, but it does make you a worse person than if you didn't cheat.
Right. So. And again, let's emphasize here that it's not a procedural mistake. It's not like, you know, oh, you shuffled incorrectly or anything. If you cheated, it means that you intentionally took advantage of your fellow man your fellow person in an unfair manner.
Right. And I think, you know, that this is not something that Wandering Winder really thinks happens, which is a big point of like disagreement on the world that I think the three of us have with him. So he said, when we were talking about the difference between premeditated cheats and cheats of opportunity, he thinks that, and I'm going to quote now, "For one thing, I don't think anybody goes into a tournament and has the conscious thought or plan in their mind, I am going to cheat." Which is just something that the three of us, I think, don't, like, we do think that people come into tournaments thinking they're going to cheat. And that is, you know, something that people do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Speck.
Exactly.
Steven Speck, the guy who palmed 7 cards for his Amulet Bloom deck, you know, he walked into the tournament hall thinking that, okay, you know, in this tournament, I'm going to palm a 7 card perfect hand against multiple opponents. And that's how I'm going to win money at this tournament. That's how I'm going to, you know, take an unfair equity of money from other players. Right. And that is a really, really bad thing. That's a bad attitude to have. Right.
And that's, yeah, and you can do, there is a difference between a premeditated cheat and a cheat of opportunity, right? The cheat of opportunity is that, like, you know, while you're playing a game with your opponent, you notice that, you know, they forgot to draw a card for their turn, and you know that you have to tell them about that, and you decide not to because it's going to increase your chance of winning the game, right? Like, that's a cheat of opportunity because you didn't come into the gaming hall deciding that you were going to cheat, but when the opportunity was presented to you, you chose to cheat. And there's even a difference there where the same action, like if you decide not to tell somebody to draw their card, if you didn't actually think that you had to, then it's not cheating. It's just, you know, you didn't know the rules. And if you don't know the rules on something, you can't ever cheat on it. That's one of the required parts of the definition of cheating. So,
yeah. And, you know, I think we've all been tempted with cheats of opportunity before, I think. Probably.
Right.
I mean, I certainly have. And, you know, I'm not a perfect human being. I didn't make the decision like in a split second, you know. It took me, this has happened to me before, and it took me, you know, a solid 5 seconds or so to convince myself to do the right thing. You know, it is a hard thing to do, I think.
And we are not advocating, you know, 10-year bans or lifetime bans for somebody who gets caught doing something like this. We're advocating these increased punishments for people that walk into the hall and do think they're going to cheat. So that is a difference in our perspective here. He also brought up our premise that it's like one of the problems with this is that it's unfair to play against somebody who was caught for cheating, which is that, you know, if they come back to the game and you get paired up against them later, our point was that, you know, now some of our mental energy is going to have to be spent on, you know, wondering if this person's cheating, looking out extra hard for them cheating. And I think that is a fair point. I think that is a reasonable argument against letting people who cheated come back. But his perspective is that there are a bunch of, you know, mental things, and you should just always be on equally high alert against all players for cheating. So yeah, I think we have a difference of opinion.
I think there you just have to balance that idea versus the ability of redemption. Basically, we were talking about before, like, you know, if it is unfair, hopefully it's not. It's not unfair to the point that you can't still play Magic. And hopefully, if this issue becomes more resolved, and, you know, hopefully people just don't cheat as much, and there are fewer suspensions and don't have to really have to worry about it. That's really our goal overall. But that, you know, if someone truly has come back, then hopefully they will, you know, make amends for what they've done, and this won't be as big an issue. So,
right. And that's kind of one of the key planks of the lifetime ban people, is that they think it's, you know, any imposition on the people who've played fairly up against these, you know, previously caught cheaters is a problem. But I think you have to balance the want to offer redemption with the want to make sure that nobody, you know, has to spend all 50 minutes of their match watching their opponent's every move like a hawk. I'm going to skip over a couple of these points, which were all good points, but we got to keep moving here. One of his big things is that he thinks that just if you always shuffle your opponent's deck, these things can happen to you, which is certainly partially true for shuffle cheats and cheats like the cheats Anteri did. If you, you know, always randomize his deck, you wouldn't be negatively affected by his cheats. But there are some people like, you know, Steven Speck's cheat, where you wouldn't catch that, or Jared Betcher's cheat, which was a cheat that he did with his opponent's deck when he was randomizing it, that you wouldn't help with that. So it really depends on the cheat, whether obviously, you know, everybody should shuffle their opponent's deck as much as they like fully randomize it. But people shouldn't be allowed to, you know, cheat to make a cheat, regardless of whether it only works if their opponents don't do that. And then finally, he has some suggestions. One of the things he suggested is like a suspension that starts out with like some amount of time as a full suspension, and then after that, there's a probationary period. And his suggestion was during this probationary period, which you can play in events, but you can't actually win prizes. And that probationary period would either last for an amount of time, an amount of events, or maybe both. And that's an interesting thought that would kind of satisfy Ben's requirement of making somebody, you know, actually prove that they've changed, because they would have to play in these events without, you know, having a chance to win prize. But I think there are certainly some implementation difficulties there. But yeah, it's, you know, I think that's a pretty valid suggestion. What do you guys think about that?
I don't know how it would work out necessarily, because if they can't get any prize, like, they're just playing the event just to play the event, and that might feel like it's just not the way a lot of people play Magic. I think there could be ways to implement it, though, and I think it's just something to think about. And I don't really have a good answer to that right now.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it certainly like feels pretty harsh, but, you know, so does making
them. There might be a way
to
make that like be the case and still be good. Like, if I had to play in some random event and I just couldn't win anything, like, I probably just wouldn't care at all, and maybe I just don't play very much of the event. Like, I don't necessarily know how it's punishing me other than just signing up for the event. And
right, sign up for the event and then drop after two rounds or whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is. Like, I think there could be ways to, like, maybe what you could just do is, like, on the probationary period, they only get, like, a portion of their winnings or something.
Right, or maybe they have to play, like, 50 regular REL games matches before they can get back to any competitive events or something
just
like that.
It is. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think there could be solutions.
I think in general, the idea of, like, you know, adding a probationary period after the full suspension is a pretty good way of, you know, increasing, of making it, you know, less of a binary thing between being banned or being unbanned.
Sure,
and I think
yeah.
that is admirable. So I think that's a useful suggestion. Anyways, thank you so much for the comment, Wandering Winder. Anybody who wants to read it in its entirety, it's posted as a comment under our episode 52, which you can find on our website, alliedstrategiespodcast.wordpress.com. So feel free to read through that there. If anybody else has, you know, further responses, we don't guarantee we'll read about all of them, or we'll talk about all of them on the show, but I definitely try to reply to every comment we get on the website. So yeah, let's move on into Card of the Week. Neil, what is your card of the week?
Ooh, so my card of the week here is Bogard Birthright. It's from Lorwyn. I'm talking about it in terms of draft. It's one black mana for a tribal sorcery goblin. That's kind of sweet. And what it does is it lets you return a target goblin card from your graveyard to your hand. So it's like a Raise Dead for goblins. The reason I'm mentioning this card is it's a card that I really didn't play, don't really remember playing with very much in the past. And it's a card I've really liked over the flashback drafts recently. And I think normally it's because I don't normally draft goblins very much, but I've had a couple scenarios where I have this and a couple Nameless Inversions, or I have like Warren Pilferers that can like loop this and get all the value. And like, there's a lot of cool interactions. I had one deck that had two Nameless Inversions, two Bogart Harbingers, which can search for a goblin, a Fodder Launch, and double Warren Pilferers. And like, this is just the best card in that deck because it can like return either creatures or kill spells or whatever it is. And the card's
lava axes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, man. Fodder Launch is good stuff. So yeah, Bogart Birthright, I think one of the cool things about these old flashback formats, and I think Lauren specifically, Lauren does a good job of it. There's a lot of these really interesting cards that really gain a lot depending on what your exact deck looks like and are super, super pushed in terms of like synergy and also have different uses. Like, because of the existence of changelings, this card just has a lot of different values depending on how many goblins you have. Do you have different types of goblins? What I mean by that is like, you know, just all creatures, or do you have spells that you can turn, all that kind of stuff. So I really like when sets encourage you to look at cards in different ways. And this card definitely does that for me. So I've been having fun drafting it and similar type things.
Cool. So Ben, what is your card of the week?
My card of the week is another common from Lorwyn. It is Battle Wand Oak. Battle Wand Oak is a 1/3 for 2 and a green. Whenever you play a tree folk spell or a forest comes and enters the battlefield under your control, Battle Wand Oak gets +2/+2 until end of turn. So this card lets you, it actually attacks for a huge amount of damage really fast, assuming you have a lot of forest and tree folk in your deck, because it frequently attacks for 5 damage on turn 4. And it's just one of the like linchpins in the tree folk deck, because it's one of the few cheap tree folks, and it's also just very good because it triggers off of all these changeling spells, all your actual big expensive tree folk, and then also just your land drops, assuming you have enough forests. So I actually had a sort of sweet little mini story to tell where I ended up drawing 3 Battle Wand Oaks and a Fertile Ground, which is like a mana ramp spell that costs 2 mana. So I ended up intentionally missing my 3rd land drop because I didn't have very many lands in my hand. I did have my 3rd one, but not very many, because I just wanted to use it to pump my Battle Wand Oaks after I got them into play. So sort of like Neil said, it's kind of cool that these cards in Lorwyn, they're like all super complicated. Even the commons are super complicated, but they sort of encourage you to do sort of weird stuff sometimes, which is pretty cool. But you know, they're pretty hostile towards new players because there's just so many cards that have so much text. So that's why they changed Magic, to make the commons more a lot simpler. But it is fun to get a little dose of Lorwyn now and again.
Yeah, the amount of like horrific feel bad blowouts that happen is like at least one per game, where you just miss something on board.
I played Lorwyn a while ago, like, you know, when it was originally out, and I loved it, and I flashbacked it, and I chump attacked, I think, twice out of the drafts that I've played so far, which is not that many. So I've chump attacked a lot of times, right? And I'm like a really enfranchised player.
How many times have your opponents chump attacked against you? Probably hundreds.
More than twice. It's, so, yeah, definitely. It's nice to get a little dose of it now and again, but I'm pretty happy with the fact that Magic has gotten a lot simpler.
I agree. There, you know, there's more than enough opportunities to make mistakes with just, you know, vanilla creatures, let alone all these onboard tricks that Lorwyn has. My card of the week is another card from Lorwyn. My card is Timber Protector, which is a rare. It costs 4 and a green. And it's a Treefolk Warrior, and it's a 4/6. And it says other Treefolk creatures you control get +1/+1. And other tree folk and forests you control are indestructible. So clearly this is, you know, a very powerful card in a tree folk strategy, and is a very high pick for that reason. Very strong, you know, card build around, all that kind of stuff. But mostly what I wanted to talk about is that when I was playing with this on Magic Online, my force didn't say indestructible on them. Now, I boarded in land destruction to see if I could destroy my own forest, but I never actually drew any while I had Timber Protector out. So there's some open-ended science question available as to whether or not this card works on Magic Online. So if anybody wants to rise to the challenge, I couldn't quite muster the energy to like do it in a solitaire game, but there's a chance that Timber Protector doesn't make your forest indestructible on Magic Online. So if that's the case, you know, think of all the refunds we could maybe get. Probably one while we test it, and that would be it. So that's my card of the week. Yeah.
We're quickly on the topic, since we were talking about, I guess there's a bunch of ethics from earlier. I also think all three of us are not in favor of like ever exploiting bugs. So I just want to kind of throw that out there.
Right. Yeah. I like doing some science when like I see something that might not work on Magic Online. I like trying once to break it, to see if it's broken, and then submitting it to Wizards so that they can fix it. Which is different than, you know, intentionally going into queues, trying to win with something that doesn't work on Magic Online.
Yeah, I don't recommend doing that.
It's the kind of thing that's actually against the terms of service as well, so it could get your Magic Online account suspended. I think that happens less often than, you know, it technically should, but it's still just not something to mess around with and is unethical, so.
All right, glad we cleared that up.
Yep, moving right along. Let's move into our main topic this week after talking for, you know, half an hour about other things, as is tradition.
It's okay, we'll just only talk about half an hour for this.
Yeah, as was foretold, the main topic, you know, not as main as it would suggest. We're going to talk about Standard a little bit this week. We were going to talk about Shadows Sealed a little bit last week, but we talked for cheating about the whole episode, or about cheating for the whole episode, rather. And now that's no longer really topical because the RPTQ, which was the last real Shadows Sealed thing, has passed. So I guess the next big limited format is going to be Eldritch Moon. So, and I guess Eternal Masters, which we're going to talk about probably next week.
Oh, yes.
Oh, Eternal Masters is coming out. You just reminded me. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited.
Wow, yeah. Tomorrow midnight, I get to do a draft.
Yeah. I'm so lucky. I'm not going to be able to get to draft until Monday, probably.
I'm going
to
do it when it comes out on Magic Online, but I do this thing where, like, every once in a while, based on like the number of subscribers, every once in a while I do what's called a draft train, and so I do a draft every single time someone like subscribes during that period. And so the last one I did was, I think, 21 hours long. So it's not like a set 24-hour stream, but it's, you know, it's sort of based on however long it goes. And so I've set one up already, and it's right after Eternal Masters comes out. So we're going to be going a lot of Eternal Masters. Hopefully I don't just lose every... I can imagine just being down like 700 tickets. But
Neil, are you going to come to Berkeley and draft in paper with us ever?
Probably not for that. I just don't really want the cards. So.
Are you up in Sacramento yet, or are you still in...
No. I'm not moving for another like week and a half, so...
Okay, well...
I'll have to come see you guys before I leave, but...
Yeah, that would be nice. We did get to hang out at the RPTQ, though. That was fun.
Yep, definitely.
Anyways, let's move on to our main topic, as was hinted at earlier, which is Standard. So we're going to talk a little bit about the current metagame. We're just off the backs of GP Costa Rica, which was tilt. You know, one of the most tilting things about GP Costa Rica is that when the Grand Prix schedule came out, it said Grand Prix San Jose, and I assumed that meant San Jose, California, which is, you know, an hour from Berkeley, which is would have been great to go to, but it was in fact San Jose, Costa Rica. That was sad, although our friend Eric did go there. I don't think he made day two, but he's a gold pro, so he doesn't have a care in the world anymore. He can make as many or as few day twos as he wants and still be in great shape. So, and he's still in Costa Rica now having a fun vacation. So congrats to Eric for having a fun vacation. And congrats to Seth Manfield for winning his 11th Grand Prix of the last 2 weeks, or something like that, which is what he did at Costa Rica with green-white tokens. Seth Manfield, of course, member of Team East West Bowl, along with you two. So were you guys in on the, you know, Standard? Were you on the green-white tokens train for the past couple weeks as well?
I haven't had a Standard tournament, so I wasn't paying that close attention. Also, I'm pretty sure Seth mulliganed to green-white tokens like the night before, just like he mulliganed to black-white the night before that GP.
Yeah, you should never, ever lock in a deck.
I think yeah. for my next standard GP, I'm just going to wait until Saturday at 1 a.m. and then message Seth and ask him for a deck list, and hopefully then I'll just win that GP.
Sounds like a pretty good plan.
That is kind of how you top eight at San Diego. We were just driving down in a car. I'm like, I think we should probably play Jeskai. Okay, what's going to go in this deck?
Well, yeah, the way we played Jeskai, right, is we asked Sam Pardee, friend of the podcast.
Yeah.
And we were like, hey, Sam, if you were going to a GP, what would you play? And he was like, I don't know, probably Jeskai. And then Neil and I were like, all right, now let's figure out what to put in this deck.
Great strategy.
So yeah, green-white tokens winning the day. Second place, we have a pretty interesting deck list. Naya Planeswalkers.
And Brandon is also a friend of mine. So congratulations to him for making the finals of a GP and qualifying for his first Pro Tour.
Yeah, close friend of the podcast, Brandon Fisher, who is 8 Gideons in the top two. I think there were something like 27 out of 32 Gideons in this top eight, so very powerful card, good showing for it. But yeah, this Naya Planeswalker deck is pretty interesting. It's got, two Arlan Cord, one Chandra Flamecaller, four Gideon Ally, and four Nissa Voices Endicar as the Planeswalker package, so that's 11 Planeswalkers. And it's got four Oath of Nissa, two Declaration in Stone, four Dromoka's Command as the spells. And then he's got, his creatures are four Ofs, Avacyn, Hangerback Walker, and Sylvan Advocate, along with two Lambholt Pacifist. So what do you think of this deck, Mr. Benjamin? Do you think that this is like a real deck that will be a part of the metagame, or do you think this was just a moonshot that this happened to do well?
So I didn't look at a deck list until just now. I cannot believe Arlan Cord is in this deck, because in my experience, Arlan Cord is just awful. But, I mean, he top eighted a GP, I didn't, so maybe he knows what's going on. I think mostly this is just more evidence towards, if you just play with Sylvan Advocate and Gideon Ally of Zendikar, your deck's just going to be great, because those cards are just great.
Yeah.
And Archangel Avacyn.
And Dromoka's Command.
And which, like, the cards to fill it in, you know, it's fine. They can be whatever. I mean, yeah, I don't know. This, I would have to play games with this deck before let's just say I'll reserve judgment until I play some games.
He's doing something right. He has two uncommons outside the land slot, and he's got some basics. So, I mean, that's well played in standard.
at least he's not playing, you know, a deck with red cards and no red sources in it.
Yeah,
like some other GP finalists.
Anyways, I think to me this top eight and the last couple top eights have been evidence that just, you know, white is insane right now, and Gideon is
green. I think it's green that's insane.
Green and white are insane right now. Like Dromoka's Command, Gideon, Avacyn, Sylvan Advocate, like these cards are so, they all work so well together, and are, you know, every other color gets like one card of that power level, and you know when you combine green and white, you get all of them, and it's just so it's so powerful when they're all together like this, and I think it actually makes the standard format pretty unhealthy, because it seems like most of the decks that can do well are, you know, based around green, white, or both in most cases, and I think that's the problem.
So my personal theory is actually just that Sylvan Advocate is the best card in standard, and it's, like, just not close. I think that Sylvan Advocate just matches up so well against such a high percentage of the best cards in standard. Like, Sylvan Advocate is a 2-3, which is really important when facing down, like, Gideon, or, like, other random 2-2s that are around, or 2-1s that show up in those white weenie lists. And then it later becomes a 4-5, which means it matches up really well against Languish and Grasp of Darkness and Archangel Avacyn, all of which are very popular cards. And also just its interaction with manlands just makes it incredibly powerful. So I think that, yeah, I think Sylvan Advocate is actually just insane and the best card in standard. And you should build a deck that had, like, if you... That's why I think that's why green is so good, because green just has tools to be good against every other deck. Like between Sylvan Advocate for playing against like fast decks, and also control decks because it's good against both for some reason. And then also you have Tireless Tracker to like compete with other mid-range decks.
Tireless Tracker is nice. That card's really dumb.
Notably absent from Brandon Fisher's main deck, although or actually Seth Manfield's either, right? No copy.
Honestly, yeah, I think that card is not that great against actually, I don't know. I mean, that card is very powerful, but
And you can actually find...
I think that card has room to be better. Like,
I wonder why it's not... I wonder why it's not in any of these deck lists. I'm not entirely sure.
You can find four copies of it in Oliver Tew's list, which finished third to fourth of Grand Prix San Jose, which is a Bant Collected Company deck, notably featuring Knight of the White Orchid and Ojutai's Command, along with Tireless Tracker, Thraben Inspector. So he's got some interesting cards slotted in here.
It's in the other Bant deck as well. But honestly, like, these green-white decks play a few too, I think. I guess, like, Nissa is a more synergistic source of card advantage for them.
Yeah, and these, you know, the Bant decks get to automatically play four Evolving Wilds, which is such a power play, you know, on turn four with Tireless Tracker. So that, I think, this is part of the reason that it shows up more often as you add more colors.
I think you have to consider the cost of drawing a card, basically, and, like, the cost of cracking clues. I think you want to be using that engine either to sort of almost end your curve or supplementing it with a lot of ways to allow you to get to use your clues as resources. Because if you just put it in, like, sort of mid-range deck and it's your 3-drop, then, like, you're going to want to cast your Gideons on 4 and your Archangels on 5 and, like, your 6-mana Planeswalkers and all these other things. So it doesn't really have room. And another card often you see it pair with is actually Duskwatch Recruiter, right? Because, like, they're both just company, these card engines. Yeah, Collected Company, exactly, where your deck is just using all its mana every single turn, but it's using it on, like, 1 and 2 mana plays for the most part. And then it's like, okay, well, you sometimes, you know, you have the ability to crack a clue and find another cheap thing, and then this card actually is, like, worth spending your mana on because then you can deploy enough threats. But
the more cheap spells you play, though, the worse a card is, right? Like,
yeah, but it allows you to spin your wheels more, right? Because you're allowed to, like, if I have 3 mana and I crack a clue and then I play a Thraben Inspector, like, I'm not necessarily, like, that behind on the board, even though I spent 2 mana on getting a card and a counter.
And also in these, like, Bant decks, you want to be operating at instant speed a lot more. Your deck is full of Collected Company, Ojutai's Command, Duskwatch Recruiter, Dromica's Command to a lesser extent, so having these clues sit around and cracking them at your opponent's end step is a much bigger upside than if your deck, you know, for the most part operates at sorcery speed. So I think that's one of the reasons that we see Tireless Tracker more often in these Bant decks, is that they value the instant speed that it adds more.
Yeah, I still wonder if it could show up in green-white tokens, because I really like the way it interacts against Gideon. Because you play Tireless Tracker, and the turn before they play Gideon. Also, I guess I should note, I'm not afraid to play Tireless Tracker on turn 3. I think it's totally reasonable to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now all of a sudden, you know, if they play Gideon and make a guy, like, you know, any 2-mana removal spell is going to kill their Gideon. Like having Tireless Tracker just as an optionally 4-power creature puts so much pressure on Gideon.
You know, yeah, I was really impressed with it in the green-black deck I played, or the Sam Blacklist, where he was, instead of the Season's Past deck, instead of it girdling, it like has Sylvan Advocates and Tireless Trackers to apply pressure. But the deck also just has infinite removal, and both those cards also can get to 5 toughness to survive the deck's own languishes. And so, like, that part of the deck actually felt really sweet. Now, some of the other aspects, I felt the deck could be a little bit clunky at times. But
Mostly the deck was noticeably worse when you did not have Tireless Tracker.
Exactly. But, like, when I was curving out with that and then playing removal spells and then drawing more cards and playing more removal spells, my opponent never got to do anything. I felt pretty powerful, and I think the card's really good, and I think, depending on the format, it could become even better. Like, if you remember back to when Khaza Tarkir first came out, I just remember going over the spoiler at least 20 times, and I'm just like, okay, can I please just get any 2-mana removal spell? You know? Do you remember that, Ben?
Yeah, I think so.
There just basically weren't any. This is before Valor Stance came out. There was no ultimate price. There's no Dromoka's Command. There's nothing anywhere playable, essentially. And there just weren't very many good two drops. Like, you had Seeker of the Way, just a bunch of bad cards at the 2 mana slot. And so standard was basically tap lands, and then you started playing Magic on turn three. And I think it just goes to show that, these different formats, different things can be so much better. And so I think if Tyler Tracker has a little bit less competition and the format isn't about necessarily using your mana on every single turn, it's like, because right now it's just a constant board struggle. That's part of the reason Languish is so good. Because it does well against a lot of these aspects. But then again, these decks just have a lot of Planeswalkers, so Languish isn't very good against that half of it. So the format's in a very interesting spot, I guess, theoretically, from that perspective. Now, from deck diversity, it doesn't look necessarily that diverse right now, but
Yeah, from a deck diversity standpoint, it really feels like it's just green white, black white, and collected company decks. And those are the three decks you can play. And if you don't want to play one of those decks, you can play one of these, crazy off the wall decks that are trying sort of very inbred built to exploit the fact that most people are playing green white, black white, or collected company.
do you have any of those decks, either of you, that you actually like more than as, the super fringe thing?
I do not. I mean, I've heard of this mono blue, Martin Mueller nonsense deck, but I've never actually played any games with or against it. But if that, I've heard that people actually like it. So, if it's good, I assume it's good just because specifically it attacks, this kind of metagame. Because I can't imagine, that sort of deck act like being a good deck in general.
So the deck's bad versus duresses, and it's bad versus counterspells.
Neil, what is the deck? Could you
Well,
give us a
black
quick
is
overview?
borderline unplayable,
Sure.
so.
So I've played probably about 10 matches with the deck, I would say. So the idea of the deck is you just draw a bunch of cards, and then you're just dirtling through your deck, and you have two different ways to win. One of them is to cast a Rise from the Tides. So you're basically playing the blue-red spells deck from, well, Limited, but in Constructed. So you have one Rise from the Tides. So you're anticipating your Nagging Thoughts, your pour through the paging. Like, you really are just playing a Limited deck. And then you cast Rise from the Tides, you get like 20 zombies or whatever. So that's one way the deck wins. Oftentimes, the second way the deck wins, which is actually more common, is chaining Awakened Part the Water Ales. And with Rise from Tides, often you play Rise from Tides and Part the Water Ale in the same turn and then attack with enough zombies. So those are the ways that the deck actually finishes a game. Now, how do you get there? One of the actually really important cards to the deck is, I think it's called, is it Prism Ring or Prism Array? I
Prism
don't know.
Ring.
Prism Ring. It's a one mana artifact that basically every time you cast a blue spell, you gain a life, which is really a clunkster. But in a deck with all blue cards where you're just spinning your wheels constantly, this gives you the time to be
Wait,
able
that
to.
card's in standard? Is it one of those ones that's that was
No,
printed in the...
it's in Origins.
It's in
It's
Origins.
Oh,
in
right, okay, yeah.
Origins. It was
I
unplayable,
lost with
honestly.
Limited once.
Right, yeah, the one mana, the one where you choose a color
Yeah,
in
so you choose
Origins.
a
Okay,
color.
yeah.
This so you choose blue because your deck is entirely mono blue, and so you spin your wheels, you draw a bunch of cards, and then you eventually set up that end game. Now, there's an important piece to this whole puzzle, which is actually the mid game.
I thought you were going to say it's pieces of the puzzle.
Nope, the deck does not play that card. And so, what you're essentially trying to do in the middle is trying to bridge the gap from, drawing a bunch of cards to taking all the turns. And so the way you do that is with Engulf the Shores and with Jace's Sanctum. Okay, so Engulf the Shores, we've seen in Limited, just ba basically bounces everything with toughness equal to or less than the number of islands you control. So that's usually going to bounce the board, although creatures get pretty big in standard quickly. But oftentimes you can just bounce everything. But really, the card that makes this whole deck tick is actually Jace's Sanctum, which is a 4 mana enchantment that doesn't affect the board.
Say no more, say no more.
It makes your spells cost one less, and when you cast an instant or sorcery, you get to scry one. So it's important to get that down as soon as possible, and then you can untap, and everything's way, way cheaper. And then you get to basically look through your whole deck to be able to chain a bunch of time walks or find an engulf that you need. Also, a key common play to the deck is turn 4 Jace's Sanctum, turn 5 play your 5th island, play Engulf the Shores, bounce everything, and then play Day's Undoing. So
that's a combination.
When you do that, you've also been playing a couple prism rings from your hand, and you've been like dumping things into play, and then you just the board is completely empty. You both have 7 cards, but you have this mana reduction effect in play, and then at that point you have 7 cards in your hand, and you can just keep basically clearing the board or not taking damage to Hydralash, and then you just start taking all the turns from there. So I've actually found the deck to be pretty good, reasonably resilient. You can get run over, but like today I played a match where I just drew all 4 of my prism rings, and I got to 2 life, and then I ended the game at like 60 life, and that was 2 turns later or whatever, but two virtual turns.
This is the kind of deck that does seem like it's good at attacking that sort of metagame I just described, right? Because
yeah.
I mean, the green-white deck can be fast, but it's not that fast most of the time. It's pretty vulnerable to Engulf the Shores, as a lot of its creatures are tokens.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like that might be a decent matchup. I've heard that the deck is pretty bad against Dromoka's Command because, like you said, Jace's Sanctum is so important. But
yeah, I was just about to mention that. It's pretty concerning, isn't it?
That's not... Obviously, that's a problem, but if people are having Dromoka's Commands in their hands, they're not really necessarily always committing to the board as much if they have that lying around. Obviously, they can have the Perfect Curve plus Dromoka's Command, but you also don't just jam Sanctum necessarily on turn 4 sometimes, like... You often can, or you'll have 2 of them, and maybe they don't have enough pressure to get rid of the second one. Or you just have a normal game where you don't draw Jace's Sanctum, and you just bounce all their stuff, and like the Dromoka's Command's blank. So it depends if you play Jace's Sanctum or not. You can obviously win without it. Day's Undoing, I think, is pretty well positioned right now. So a lot of the elements just work and line up really, really nicely. Like, you get to invalidate a lot of what people are doing, which is trying to just have more stuff on the board, because you just don't care about that. Like, I had a game today. My opponent's curve was turn 2 Hedron Crawler, turn 3 the 4/4 Red Flyer. What's that guy? Thunderbrick Regent. Turn 4, they played a Hangerback on 1 and a Thopter Engineer, and they played a turn 5 Chandra. And I was just gaining life slowly by casting blue cards, and then I like bounced all the creatures a couple times, and then I just started setting up my engine, and my opponent got Chandra, I think, to 9. That game. They just plussed every single turn and like kept playing things to the board and spent all their mana every single turn. But because I was just like being able to gain more life than they can deal me damage and just like keep the board clear and then like resetting our hands at the right times, I just didn't care the fact that they were dealing me 6 every single turn with Chandra. So the deck definitely attacks from a unique axis. And I think what also really sells me is the sideboard. This deck, it has a bunch of counter magic in the sideboard, which can help improve kind of tricky matchups or any mirrors as well. A card I was really impressed with was Invasive Surgery, because people bring in all these Transgress the Minds and Duresses against you. So that can be a nice way to just hold your own. Also, Day's Undoing, once people rip apart your hand, like you can just top deck that card and you're just right back in it. So that's really nice.
That's what I was going to say. Like you mentioned that it was weak to Duress a while ago, but it does seem like the deck is pretty robust to Duress if you just have a bunch of draw spells in your deck, right? Like,
yeah, I mean,
you're just going to top deck more draw spells. Like,
they can it can hurt setting up your engines and things, but like, you obviously still have game against it. And then you basically have Thing in the Ice that you bring in almost every single matchup. Now people now know that you have that, so they sometimes keep in removal. But then, like, if they keep in removal, you don't bring Thing in the Ice. It's always that, you know, delicate dance because you never need Thing in the Ice. But sometimes it's a good way to just quickly kill your opponent. One thing I've noticed from this deck that you want to be careful about, if you bring in Thing in the Ice, you really don't want to bring much else in. You want to make sure that you're having enough spells to actually flip your Thing in the Ice, as great as that sounds, you know? Oftentimes you'll bring it in matchups where your opponent has a ton of removal and they're kind of dirtling or whatever. In those types of matchups, you can afford to cut Prism Rings, so you're not hurting your spell count. There's other matchups where people often slow down to try to interact with you post-board. So you can cut your, like, maybe a Prism, a ring or two, and then a couple Hydralashes. So you can find room for that. And actually today I played Carson's version, which splashes black. And the reason it splashes black is just for Dragon Lord Silumgar out of the board.
Ooh.
Oh, it was a delight. I played a match, my opponent had Reality Smashers, and I just played a Silumgar, and like, instead of just playing this dirtily match, I just killed him with Reality Smasher, and he's like, what just happened? And I'm like, well, decided not to dirtle this game, what do you want? So, yeah, the deck's definitely sweet. I would definitely test it even more intently if I thought, you know, I was going to play a big tournament coming up. Unfortunately, I have to be moving the weekend of the WMCQ, which is coming up. Otherwise, I might just play it there. I definitely think it's a good deck.
You do have a pretty good history with rogue decks and standard at the WMCQ.
Yeah, it's probably bad.
Maybe I should ask Neil for a deck list.
Yeah, Neil for the WMCQs and Seth for the GPs.
Yeah.
I think it would warrant maybe more testing and playing there, but I think if people are just playing creatures, this deck's very, very powerful.
What about splashing other colors like red for Chandra, white for Ojutai?
You want to be careful because your whole deck is designed to just play blue instants and sorceries. That's what it's trying to do. So if you go too far from that, you lose a lot of the synergy aspect of the deck. So I don't know about that. Like, I wasn't necessarily sold on the black splash, but I think post-board, everyone's just trying to, like, grind you out with, like, planeswalkers and having gates and all these types of things, and you can just play a Dragon Lord Silumgar and randomly kill them. So,
right, I guess the nice thing about it being black or white is that you still get to play islands in Prairie Stream or
I think Ojutai, you could definitely try a white splash. I think that would be okay thought Ojutai was great. But
the problem with red for Chandra is that you'd have to play a lot of non-islands, and that would hurt Engulf the Shore, and
yeah, it's just not.
Now we're in a downward spiral of making a deck that does two things badly instead of one thing well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest appeals to this deck is its mana is just so good. It's just, you just have 25 islands or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas these green-white decks, God, the mana is just awful. It's gotten less awful, I think, when as people like played fewer and fewer Thraben Inspectors. But, you know, just having your like 15-15 mana base with your double green card and your double white card, like, it's just so miserable.
On a tangential note, did you know that Ben will not add Thraben Inspector to his cube, despite me lobbying him for many miles of a car ride?
I feel like, come on, give that card some respect.
Yeah,
nice little speed bump.
Are you guys serious? Like, okay,
yes.
I guess we can ask the guys, tweet at me or Tristan or whatever, you know, would you add Thraben Inspector to a powered cube?
No, I wouldn't do that. I also wouldn't add it to like one of our cubes because they're super powerful and they have only broken spells.
Right, it is pretty warping to add a Thraben Inspector to powered cube, but it would be all about who opens it.
I would snap add it to the Magic Online cube.
Well, I've been told
that
the reason Ben doesn't have it in the cube is that he doesn't actually own one. So, listeners, if you want to send, if you could mail Benjamin a Thraben Inspector, that would really help us out here. Yeah, a foil Thraben Inspector, or you know, just mail him really anything you want to Ben. That would be good. What were we talking about? Standard, right? I guess we've mostly talked about standard. So this mono blue thing is you think a real thing to attack this really, really inbred, you know, green white mid rangey metagame?
I think
that sounds
very
pretty good
versus those decks.
I'm gonna try it out as well. Hopefully, you know, even if this doesn't end up being the best deck, hopefully its existence makes the metagame a little bit less boring.
Yeah, I think mostly this sort of deck is just a lesson, like, you know, when metagames get this skewed and the deck isn't broken, because I don't believe green-white is broken, like, you usually can come up with something that exploits it.
Right, this is like the Cobblade test, right? Which is, okay, the deck is now 90% of the top tables. Can we make it not 90% of the top tables? And as long as the answer is yes, then it's not a huge problem.
And I think that there are some really talented deck builders out there who will figure out a way to exploit this kind of metagame. I guess one thing we didn't talk about is Cryptolith Rites decks. And I should mention that I think Cryptolith Rites decks are just, they're bad now. I think that they were, the four color one was good while it was a surprise because you had like a good matchup against green white. But now like that, I think that was because like they just didn't know what was happening. They didn't understand that the deck just has a combo that can kill you. And nowadays, the green-white decks like understand the four-color rights and have good sideboards against it. Like they transform with these Wrath of Gods, and so it's just not nearly as good a matchup anymore. And so I think that, and also your rights deck is like not very good against black-white control. You're probably still pretty good against Bant Company, but the Bant Company decks have been skewing more towards like a humans build, so they're like so much faster than the traditional super grindy Bant decks that couldn't really interact with your combo. So I think that the Crypto with Rights decks, they need a new innovation, or because I just think that the current ones are not very good.
And that reminds me about, you're talking about bad matchups. If you want to beat the mono blue deck that we've been talking about, which I don't know why you would want to, but if you play Saito's blue red flyers deck,
oh yeah,
that is
Fevered Visions.
So they're playing Fevered Visions. You're already drawing cards. They're playing a bunch of 2/1 flyers that just, they can recast at instant speed if you ever want to engulf. They're playing a 4/9 haste flyer that you can't engulf. They have main deck like Stratus Dancers and Negates or whatever, and it's just like, okay, well, I can never ever win. So that's,
oh yeah. I guess we should have mentioned that deck as another like wacky inbred deck that plays really bad cards but does well because other decks just aren't equipped to beat it. Like flyers are just really good against planeswalkers, right? Fevered Visions is just insane against black-white control. Like, that deck has 4 Read the Bones and, like, 3 Anguished Unmakings and like, Obnixilus or whatever. Just, like, a million ways to lose life, right? And Fevered Visions is just great against them. So I think a Fevered Visions deck could be great in this metagame also if you can figure out how to build it good against green-white.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might be pretty hard, though.
Yeah, I mean, Fevered Visions is definitely a card that this podcast has a history of liking, so.
This is my favorite card.
All right, let's see. Do you guys want to move on now to the termination of this week's episode?
Perhaps? Sure, sure, sure. We better Benjamin, have a good story.
Benjamin, would you like to give us a
decent story, I guess?
Yeah.
All right, so this story is sort of a two-parter. Let me tell the first part. Let me tell it in reverse chronological order. So I was playing the Bant Eldrazi deck recently at Grand Prix LA, and I played against Burn. And my Burn opponent, I guess I probably told this recently, actually. Well, anyway, my Burn opponent, kept a hand. He was in the dark. I mulliganed. But his hand ended up being sort of slow, but it had a bunch of Eidolon of the Great Revels in it, which, you know, is frequently Burn's best card against a lot of people because it's just guaranteed damage. But I was playing Eldrazi. So my opponent played, you know, Eidolon of the Great Revel, and I was just like, thought not seer you. And I saw another Eidolon of the Great Revel, and I took something else. He was like, Eidolon of the Great Revel. And I was like, Drowner of Hope. Look at how high CMC my cards are. I don't take any damage. And then eventually I just ended up tapping both of his Eidolons with my Drowner so that he couldn't jump lock and attacked him down to 3 or whatever. And so he's just locked out of playing spells for the rest of the game. Then I just eventually draw another Drowner and kill him. So that was sort of an amusing story of Eidolon of the Great Revel gone wrong. And this also happened to me at actually Pro Tour Oath of the Gatewatch, which was, Pro Tour Eldrazi Winter or whatever. I was playing an Eldrazi deck, also playing against Burn. This was, you know, right when Eldrazi came out, so people didn't really understand what was going on. And my opponent ended up, keeping in Eidolon of the Great Revel against me post-board. And I just drew all spells that cost 4 more mana again. And it actually got to the point where his Riftbolt was coming off suspend to put him to 4. And he just went in the tank. And he was like, all right, I mean, I guess I just got to Riftbolt my own Eidolon of the Great Revel. I was just like, so I just thought that was a little amusing.
Yeah, we've all been on the wrong side of that, but.
Do what you gotta do.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah,
He gave himself the best chance to win that game by killing his own idol on a Great Revel, but unfortunately, when he showed up to the tournament, he did not give himself the best chance to win the tournament.
Yep. And unfortunately for all you, that's this week's episode. But Fortunately for you, we'll see you next time for more Allied Strategies.